From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tite. Today on the program, a national policy analyst offers his take on who's to blame for the high rate of black male incarceration in Milwaukee.
So it's not that black people are more likely to commit crimes. It's that the police are more likely to arrest them.
But Milwaukee's police chief says not so fast, the issue isn't that simple.
The five zip codes that produce the most incarcerated males produce two-thirds of the violent crime in this city, and the victims are other African Americans.
Plus, is there mission shift at the Wisconsin DNR? And enough of the cheesy sweaters, Jeanette Hurt has some real cheesy suggestions for the holidays. Lake Effect is next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tite. Thanks so much for being with us today. WUWM's Project Milwaukee is in the middle of an extensive look in conjunction with Milwaukee Public TV at the issue of incarceration among black men in the community. Previous stories and interviews have set out to quantify the situation, and in the future, we'll examine the impact it's having on the community at large and the people and organizations working to improve the situation. This month, we're exploring the factors that led Wisconsin to have the highest percentage of incarcerated African-American men in the country, according to the latest census. It's an issue that Michael Holtzman has studied and written about recently. Holtzman was formerly an education policy analyst, but has expanded his work, and he wrote passionately about what he believes is to blame in a column for the website Daily Kos. He joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, let's talk about this issue of black male incarceration in Milwaukee in particular. And you write pretty strongly about this. Who do you see in the power structure that you believe is making the decisions that have led Milwaukee down this road to its disproportionate rate of incarcerating black men?
Well, actually, I'm very happy that you phrased it that way, because many people think that these decisions are being made by the black men and not by the people who are controlling the institutions. The criminal justice system, if we're concentrating on that, has three main components. There's the police, there's the prosecutors, and there's the judges. The police, in some places, it's the sheriff's department, but I believe Milwaukee is a police department, has a chief of police. The chief of police makes rules about what counts as a crime, where to concentrate forces, what to do about it. So I'd say that the disproportionality of arrests follows from decisions made by the chief of police. The prosecutors work for the district attorney. The district attorney, in the same way, sets policies and emphasis. And so the decisions about who gets prosecuted lies with the district attorney and his or her assistants. There was a good illustration of this a year or so ago where the police were in another city. Were arresting large numbers of young black men for trespassing in the apartment houses in which they lived. And the police took these cases to the local district attorney, and the district attorney refused to prosecute. So there can be people who are taking personal responsibility in a positive way. The third component is the judge, and the judges decide on convictions and on sentencing and the level of punishment.
All three of those institutions or individuals, in some cases, could make the case that they work on behalf of the people of Wisconsin or the people of Milwaukee or the people of Milwaukee County. And in turn, the legislature is what determines all of this. Is there a point higher up the chain that needs to be pointed to as well?
What you have in Milwaukee is an extremely egregious situation. If you have 10 times as many black people imprisoned in Milwaukee as white people, and this is either the first or second highest in the country, we're not talking about little shades of gray here. We're talking about something that is shouting out that there is a real serious problem.
We've heard this contention from several people. We interviewed Lois Quinn, who co-authored the study that really focused so much attention on the disparities. We've heard that crimes are committed by both blacks and whites, but there are some for which blacks are far more likely to be arrested. Is it possible to tease those numbers out? Have you been able to look and say that that it's just a case of more blacks being arrested for the same crimes that white people could have been arrested for as well?
Well, if we look at drug use, drug use is really what drives this thing. It is the clearest case. Studies going back a generation have shown that drug use is similar in all populations. What you have is at least four times the percentage of African Americans as white people are arrested and imprisoned for drug use. So it's not that black people are more likely to commit crimes. It's that the police are more likely to arrest them.
Why isn't the answer to just arrest and convict more white male offenders?
Well, that would be an interesting thing. You think that would be supported by the voters?
Well, I think it's a fair question.
Well, I think it is a fair question. I think because that what would happen then would be that the laws would be changed. The use of cocaine, which again is a highly egregious situation, is generally higher in white professional classes than it is among poor people. Costs a lot. And if the laws about cocaine were enforced with white people, there'd probably be very serious consideration given to changing those laws.
There are, of course, a lot of people who have heard the interviews in our series and have written in or emailed to say, what about personal responsibility of the people who commit the crimes, that these issues wouldn't be nearly as extreme if black men in the community made better choices?
I think the important point about personal responsibility is the personal responsibility of the people we were talking about earlier. Personal responsibility of the chief of police, of the district attorney, of the judges involved. They are severely damaging the social fabric of the city. And whenever the chief of police directs that police activity will take place primarily or in large part in all black communities, he is severely straining the economic and social fabric of that area of the city. And that then follows for the district attorney and the judges. The personal responsibility of the people who are being arrested is a very tricky subject. In many places in the country on drug possession, the police will stop somebody and say, "Show me what's in your pocket." And although it's not illegal to carry marijuana in your pocket, it is illegal to show it in public. So usually a young man, terrified by this police officer, shows the police officer what's in his pockets, which might be a marijuana cigarette, which is not illegal to have in the pocket. But as soon as it's out in the open in his hand, then he's arrested.
Well, let me ask, what is the answer to something like that?
The answer is for the police not to try to trick people in that way. Not to try to score points or to get good recommendations on the basis of how many people they arrest. The answer is community policing that is intended and practiced to improve the quality of life in the neighborhood.
Well, and what about on the, if not on the enforcement end, certainly in the when you start talking about the fabric of the neighborhood, one could make an argument that, okay, maybe arresting people for having a marijuana cigarette in their pocket isn't the ideal solution, but nor is a neighborhood where significant numbers of people are using or selling drugs. What do you do on that end of the equation to, say, improve the quality of life, if not for taking people off the street?
I think you have to balance these things. And, reasonable people might be able to differ to some extent. But the situation in Milwaukee is that you have between 30 and 50% young adult black males who are in prison or have been in prison. And it's clear to everybody that this has a horrible effect on the economic situation of people in their neighborhoods. While they're in prison, they can't support their families. When they're out of prison, they're unlikely to get good jobs, and they're actually unlikely to get any jobs at all. So what you get is a catastrophic economic decline that's directly attributable to the practices of the police and the rest of the criminal justice system. And the people who really suffer from this are the children. You have 40% of families in Milwaukee with children are living in poverty. Those children don't have much of a chance in life. And the reason they don't have much of a chance in life is the disparate enforcement of these victimless crime laws.
Your previous focus was largely on education in your work, and I'm curious where you see education falling in this particular dynamic.
The key to that is a education funding system. Education funding system in the United States is unique. I haven't come across any other in the world where schools are funded on the basis of the economic status of the parents of the children, which is property tax. Therefore, people living in poor neighborhoods, because they're poor, go to schools that are poorly funded. People living in wealthier neighborhoods, because they're wealthy, have children going to school in wealthier neighborhoods. This then just perpetuates the situation. The thought comes, perhaps, that what's going on here is a difference in capacity of the children in Wisconsin. The chances of a black male student graduating from the Milwaukee Public Schools are very slight. The chances of a black male student graduating from a Wisconsin school not in Milwaukee are four or five times as great. I doubt if the kids just outside of Milwaukee are significantly different in their native capacity than the kids in Milwaukee. The variable here is schools, the way they're funded, and the way that the resources are apportioned.
Well, and in fact, you make the comparison of family situations in Milwaukee to what African Americans would see if they moved to Mississippi, which is often used as a benchmark for poor economics. And you come to the conclusion that African Americans would be slightly better off there.
Yeah, the climate's better too. they would be, and I'm not making a case for Mississippi. It's just that the situation in Milwaukee is so terrible that even Mississippi, which is at the bottom of all possible indicators, is doing better.
There's a lot that's been made about how segregated a city Milwaukee is. How would you contend that affects this equation? Would incarceration be affected if neighborhoods here were more ethnically mixed, do you think?
There are two ways to approach this education issue, and then I think that approach there are two ways to approach the incarceration issue. If the neighborhoods were mixed, then the schools would be better, not because it's better to have integration, but because no white-dominated school board is going to make a school that is significantly populated by white kids as bad as the schools that are overwhelmingly black. And then as educational outcomes for children improve, the potential earning capacity of those children once they become adults improves, the chances that they're going to be incarcerated decrease, and lives get better. The segregation is just incredible. When I was trying to place Chinese teachers from China in schools in Milwaukee, I was told that the primary problem was going to be to find some place for them to live because the city was so segregated that there was no appropriate neighborhood for the Chinese.
Is there a comparison to be made to how New York City has taken on low-level offenses?
Yes. If the vivid example that has just occurred is with what they call stop and frisk, and I understand there's a parallel program in Milwaukee having to do with automobiles. In New York, the previous regime had the police chief instructed the police to stop as many black and Latino young adults and teenagers on the streets as possible, ask them to reveal anything that's in their pockets, and arrest those who had some kind of violation, and particularly if they had guns. And there were the last quarter in 2012, I think it was, there was something on the order of 200,000 of these stops. They found virtually no guns. They found that the amount of offenses available were the same for whites as for blacks, and yet the incredibly overwhelming majority of stop and frisk were of black and Latino youth. When the federal judge said that this was unconstitutional, the number of these things dropped by 90%. Crime rate remained on the same declining curve it had been at, and arrests remained the same. So this kind of activity had no effect except to criminalize a generation of young black adults.
Michael Holtzman, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Michael Holtzman was formerly research consultant for the Schott Foundation on Public Education. He now does research and writes about issues involving racial disparities in a number of policy areas. You'll find a link to his column for Daily Kos from WUWM.com/Lake Effect. Milwaukee Police Chief Edward Flynn has another take on where the police department fits into this picture. We'll speak with him when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. Before the break, researcher Michael Holtzman talked about the factors he sees as contributing to the high rate of black male incarceration in Milwaukee. High among them was the Milwaukee Police Department's role in enforcement and how arrests for sometimes nonviolent crime feed into the cycle of incarceration. Not surprisingly, the police department itself has a different take on how it fits into the equation. Edward Flynn is Milwaukee's chief of police, and he joins us in the studio to discuss that issue and also some of the top storylines for the police department in 2013. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So I want to start with a few questions linked to our Project Milwaukee series. Several people we've spoken with have pointed to the role of law enforcement, and so I wanted to get your take on a couple of the most consistent critiques that we've heard. And one is this idea that there are traffic infractions that are happening for which black drivers are stopped, things like burned out lights over license plates, seatbelt violations, tinted windows in certain neighborhoods, while white drivers in what people might think of as safer neighborhoods are not pulled over. And let me just ask you, is that happening?
We do traffic enforcement all over the city. But I think I need to clarify something and provide some perspective. We try to make our practices evidence-based. And there has been substantial research in the past that's indicated that when the General Patrol Force engages in traffic enforcement activity, it can have a direct impact on the amount of street crime in the areas in which these stops take place. So we embarked on a very assertive program of doing car stops in high crime areas, but we specifically stipulated in the policy that started this initiative that the goal was not to raise revenue and burden poor people with tickets because we were trying to protect them. We wanted to use traffic infractions as a lawful reason to stop cars in high crime areas. Why? Because these are where the most stolen cars are, because the robberies occur here, because people who steal cars often commit robberies with them. Groups of young men in stolen Chrysler minivans are one of the most frequent perpetrators of robberies in the city. So the goal is to have an impact on that behavior through the use of traffic enforcement. You know, as I said, we told our officers, if you can possibly give a warning out, do it. So, you know, we ramped up our traffic stops probably from something like 50-some thousand a year to 180,000 a year. And every year, the number of citations we gave out decreased. All right?
So that number you have is for stops, but right. Some of those people who are stopped don't get citations.
80% of the people we stop don't get a citation. We are obviously in positions where if somebody does something truly reckless and we stop them, or if they don't have a license, and I know that's been an issue addressed by this series, but I mean we're kind of left holding the bag. If we stop, you don't have a license, we can't say, you know, go and drive. But we are not writing lots of tickets for, you know, broken taillights, even though we're stopping people for it. People who make the right turn on the stop sign but didn't put anybody in danger, we'll stop them at that area because we're really, you know, every week we map the car stops. Are they where the crimes are occurring? But in the last 10 months, 18% of our car stops ended up with citations. Now, that doesn't mean we couldn't have written the other 82% of citations. We could have, but we elected not to because they're trying to use intelligent discretion and not inadvertently impose a poor people's tax because poverty and street crime are highly concentrated in the same places. And that's something that we're committed to doing something about because we're convinced that the neighborhoods which are characterized by high rates of poverty and unemployment cannot make a comeback as long as they are seen accurately as dangerous places to live and work. And so traffic enforcement does as a tool to achieve that. But I do want to emphasize that we are very much, you know, 80% of the time oriented towards not issuing the citation if we can avoid it, because we understand that can have an adverse impact on people without means.
There was a recent report that showed non-whites constitute about 82% of the people who received failure to pay forfeiture suspensions. So there are people who say that, you know, they look at that statistic and say, well, this means that African Americans and other minorities are being targeted more aggressively. Is that number striking to you, that the number of African Americans and other minority group members are so heavily represented in this failure to pay forfeiture suspension?
Well, here's what's disproportionate to me. All right. With about, what, 40% of Milwaukee's population, 42% of Milwaukee's population, African Americans represent 80% of our homicide victims. They represent 60% of our robbery victims. They represent 80% of our aggravated assault victims. They represent half of our burglary victims. They represent 56% of our car theft victims. So far, just this year, okay, just this year, 2,000 African Americans have been robbed. During that same period of time, 3,200 of them have been assaulted, okay? And in both cases, between 80 and 90% of the suspects were other African Americans. It's dangerous to live in these neighborhoods, and the people that are suffering the brunt of the grotesque disparity in victimization are the African American community. Now, I recognize people want to scrutinize the criminal justice system to make sure that it's fair and impartial, but I almost never hear this data referenced. It is though the arresting of African Americans takes place in some vacuum, disconnected to the reality of the fact that if I draw an ellipsis over our poorest neighborhoods and then find an ellipsis and draw it where our most 911 calls are, in other words, people asking for help, and then draw the ellipsis over where most of our crime victims are, and the same ellipsis is where most of our abandoned houses are, we've done this exercise. It's the same in neighborhoods and the same zip codes. And the same zip codes that produce most of the prisoners that have been referenced in this produce most of the city's crime victims. The five zip codes that produce the most incarcerated males produce two-thirds of the violent crime in this city, and the victims are other African Americans. Now, we're at the front end of the system, and what do we recognize? We, the police, are the social agency of first resort for the poor. We intervene in all manner of events in the lives of the poor because we're all there is. The bigger picture here is the criminal justice process and who's in jail is the end result of a large number of interrelated social failures. And the people that are left dealing with the result of American society's disinvestment in education and disinvestment in housing and disinvestment in healthcare and disinvestment in mental health services, all that's left are the people and the police. We're it. And we're in it together. Certainly, you know, raising the specter of the disparate impact incarceration has on these communities is important. But let's expand the analysis of what it's related to. Okay? If every year I know that 2,000 African Americans are going to get robbed and 92% of the described suspects are African American, am I not obligated to bring justice to the victim and attempt to apprehend the offender? That is our reality. And I think all too often what gets lost in this discussion is the larger disparity of all, which is the disparity of being a victim of crime, correlates with race and poverty in our city.
Now, you are obviously, as the police department, not an agency of sentencing, but what do you see as the role of mandatory minimums in this equation? Is it something that you think needs to be reconsidered?
Well, I think it has been reconsidered in Wisconsin. I believe a few years ago they developed a sentencing matrix, by and large, to compensate for problems with mandatory minimums about drug offenses. But I've also advocated, however, myself, I've advocated for a mandatory minimum for one crime and one crime only, and that's the illegal carrying of a firearm. Because what we're finding is that we have a number of homicide victims would be alive today if the person who shot them was serving a sentence or having already been arrested with a gun. You know, our problem is to change the mental calculation of our young offenders, because right now for them, if they choose a life of crime, it's more dangerous to not have a gun than to have a gun. Because getting arrested with a gun in this state is a misdemeanor, no matter how many times you're arrested. And our offenders are carrying guns at significant levels. We are seizing 2,000 guns a year from the streets of this city. That is a proportion every bit as high as Chicago's, in fact, higher than Chicago's rate of gun seizures. Now, that's significant because those young men are representing threats to themselves, to others, and they're terrorizing their communities. And we're trying to do something about it. And there are few tools at our disposal. So I would argue that mandatory sentences for drug possession are misguided. And I think it's a direction most of the country is heading away from, although there are still legacy costs from prior offenders serving time. But there are specific types of crimes. I think it is very useful. I mean, any mandatory sentence should have in it escape clauses for certain kinds of unusual circumstances. But we've got to change the decision making because the young men out there are armed with high quality, high capacity firearms, and they're using it. Every year in this city, there's a slow motion mass murder of young men by other young men in these neighborhoods. And that needs to be addressed on its own merits because the choices after that event takes place is somebody's dead and somebody else is going to prison, affecting the same statistics that this series has already covered.
Let me ask a logistical question. I mean, I would imagine that a fair number of weapons charges come about as a result of these weapons being carried in cars that are stopped for traffic violations and, mm-hmm. and probably drug charges as well. What are the rules in terms of whether an officer is permitted to do a more intensive search of a car following a traffic stop?
Searches are dependent upon whether or not people have reasonable suspicion or have permission. Now, historically, very often, people would consent to a search of their vehicle. All right. And consent searches generated a fair amount of drug arrests over time. This past year, we reexamined our policy. Our goal in the car stops is not to seize more small amounts of drugs. It's never been our goal. Goal is to affect the amount of violent crime in public spaces in Milwaukee by generating high visibility police activity where these events are occurring. And so when we saw this was happening here, we refigured the policy, and the policy now says that you're not to ask consent for the search of a car unless you can articulate what your reasonable suspicion was. Now, legally, a consent search doesn't require reasonable suspicion. You can just, out of curiosity, search somebody's car. We're not encouraging that because we're trying to make sure that we are focused on the right offenders. I mean, in any given year, less than 10% of our offenders generate over half of our crime. As a matter of fact, in the first 6 months of last year, we had, I believe, something on the order of 80 juveniles who'd been arrested for four felonies in 6 months. Okay? We have serious high-rate offenders out there that start young. That's what we want to focus on. We don't want to trip over somebody that otherwise doesn't have a serious record, but because they gave us consent, we end up with a drug arrest. We're addressing that, and we're learning as we're going.
You talked about the increased rate of traffic stops that you've made, the ramping up of enforcement. Is, you know, the perception exists, I think, out there that officers are required to do a certain number of stops. Are there – I mean, do you tell your officers when they're going out that they should be making so many traffic stops?
No, there's no quota, but we do expect activity, okay? And we see that when – I mean, we have done this study with people that are qualified to do research. Our rate of car stops directly correlates with our rate of stolen cars. When the car stops go down, the stolen cars go up. When the rate of car stops go up, the stolen cars go down. Right now, our stolen cars in Milwaukee are about 50% less than they were before I got here. And that's directly attributable to our assertive behavior in the high crime neighborhoods. And keep in mind, this isn't just somebody's car is stolen. If you are an underemployed individual and you've got a car and that car gets stolen, there's a good chance you're going to lose your job because you can't get to it. All right? Public transportation doesn't get a lot of the places people need to do to get to work. And if they've got to take time off and get a car and get it registered, they're not going to be insured for stolen. They're going to have insurance or liability. That's all they're going to have. You're going to put a major crimp in their economic lifeline and maybe cost them their job. So, you know, reducing stolen cars isn't just an exercise in property crime. This is a direct impact on employment and economic viability, again, where the most stolen cars are, which is, once again, the disparity that afflicts poor people of color in this city.
When you go back and look at and assess the effectiveness of these programs, do you look at racial demographics of traffic stops as one of the things?
We analyze the racial demographics of traffic stops. We're the only city in the entire state that does this. You'll recall a law was passed some years ago which would require this data collection. But then when the new administration came into office, they had that law repealed. We voluntarily committed and made the announcement we would produce the data. And our reason to do that is we need to be able to explain to this community that we know what the demographic impact is of our enforcement strategies and that it is explainable. So when we look at our disparities, so to speak, we want to see if they match up with the other disparities. So when we analyze our car stops, we do it district by district by district. And we expect to see a lot more white people stopped in the south side of town in District 6 than we do in Districts, 3, 5, and 7. And we expect to see more African Americans stopped in those districts than we see stopped in District 6. So far, our analysis as proxy measures, we look at the number of crime victims in that district, what their demographics are, the demographics of offenders, the demographics of car stops. And if the demographics of our car stops roughly line up with the demographics of the offenders and the victims, we feel that it's not really a racial disparity then. And so far, every year that we've done this, they haven't lined up perfectly, but they've certainly been within a margin of error to indicate to us that we're in the right places and we're not using inappropriate discretion.
Let's turn to the year that just finished. What do you think was the strongest storyline for the MPD over the past 12 months?
Well, I think we are taking major steps in trying to strengthen our most vulnerable communities by working with a variety of community groups to develop neighborhood-based leadership initiatives. With a Byrne Innovation Grant that we received from the Justice Department, we're working very hard in the Washington Park area to not just to create safe public spaces, but to create the ability among the people that live there to advocate for themselves and to form social bonds so they can create the level of social capital necessary for informal social control. With a Building Neighborhood Capacity Grant from the White House, we're working in the Amani neighborhood and the Metcalf Park neighborhood to do something very similar, which is to build in those – I mean, they're some of the poorest, most crime-ridden neighborhoods in the city. We're trying to build the ability of the people that are remaining there who are committed to conventional lives to work together to get the services they need from the city and to resist crime. And we're focusing – we were able to get money from the state for targeted demolitions. We're hoping to target those demolitions again in our highest crime neighborhoods to take out some of those buildings that are having the most negative impact where people live. I think that's very encouraging. On the downside, very frustrating for us. At the end of the first 6 months of this year, this city was on pace to have a record low number of homicides. It would have been the lowest number of homicides probably in 30 years. Then we had 20 homicides in 1 month, August, and 14 more in September. In 2 months, we had as many homicides as we had in the first 6 months of this year. And we're going to come in up in homicides. And that's very frustrating to us. We've been tracing the guns. We've been working hard on the social networks of the offenders. We're working very hard to focus on the high-rate offenders, focusing our enforcement efforts where these crimes have occurred in their greatest number. But it's been extremely frustrating for us as we're seeing a great deal of impulsive, immature violence out there that's very hard to interdict because it's episodic and not necessarily related to something that was predictable.
Well, Chief Flynn, best wishes at 2014.
Thank you very much, and thanks for giving me an opportunity to address this important issue.
Edward Flynn is Milwaukee's chief of police. There's more of our conversation at WUWM.com/Lake Effect. You'll also find the other segments from our Project Milwaukee series there as well. Another break now, and then the charge of the DNR and how it's shifted under the direction of Secretary Kathy Stepp. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. More of Lake Effect now. I'm Mitch Teich. The mission of the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources reads kind of like a poem. To protect and enhance our natural resources, our air, land, and water, our wildlife, fish, and forests, and the ecosystems that sustain all life. To provide a healthy, sustainable environment and a full range of outdoor opportunities. To ensure the right of all people to use and enjoy these resources in their work and leisure. And it goes on. At the helm of the department is a woman whose appointment raised a few eyebrows across the state, Kathy Stepp, a former home builder and state senator from Racine. Writer Maggie Ginsburg-Schutz describes how the DNR has evolved. In the January issue of Milwaukee Magazine, she tells Lake Effect's Susan Bentz that the assignment started off as a pretty straightforward profile.
As I started to read about her and about DNR, it just became clear that there was actually a much larger sort of taking a step back, big picture trend going on, just a shift, I guess, within DNR that well predated her administration and Governor Walker's administration.
Who did you first – with whom did you first speak? Did you go first to Kathy Stepp, go to her office?
Last to Kathy Stepp. In fact, I didn't expect her to speak to me. And so I kind of started from the outside of the circle and worked my way in for many months, just reading as much as I could and talking to as many people as I could, many of whom do not appear in the story, unfortunately. I mean, there was just so much. There was so much. What I found was that there was a lot of really good reporting out there, really good reporting on individual situations that were arising within DNR, just sort of these pockets of controversies that people were reporting. Outdoors writers and bloggers were writing about specific issues, and it was all over. I mean, there was – I don't think I've ever found so much information available to me on one story, which is really also what informed me that there was a larger, big picture story going on here. And then when I did go to her in the end, I asked for 15 minutes by phone, and she sat down with me for an hour and a half.
Kathy Stepp is serving at a time of controversies in our state, the proposed mine and the Pinokies, the legislation around that, the Sporting Heritage Council grant, mushrooming, as you wrote, of frac sand mining operations in the western part of the state. And she's sort of dodging. I don't know if she thinks of herself as dodging bullets.
She might. What I found about all this was that I don't think anyone disagrees that there's this shift. It's just whether or not this shift is a bad thing. I think that she's very passionate about the changes that need to be made and about the how hard she's working to implement them. And I can't imagine keeping up with all the different controversies or issues or things that the DNR has to have its hands in. And she just kind of has to be everywhere all at once. And just in trying to read about it all, you know, I think that there are these key issues, like you mentioned, the frac sand mining, the wolves, you know, just these individual pockets of controversies where these things are very, very critical to the people that are living them.
One of the issues that we've talked about is the wolf hunt. We're now into the second hunt, and there's a lawsuit looming over, I think, Kathy Stepp and the DNR. They're being sued by animal rights groups and other conservation groups. So you talked with a retiree who was part of the wolf conservation phase for that animal.
Randy Jerwitz.
Does the wolf issue stand out to you among one of the hottest that you delved into?
Or? I think the wolf issue is huge. And it may have seemed like one minute they were endangered and on the license plates and the next minute we're hunting them. But I think that up north it has been going on a lot longer and it is far more complex and it's very heated emotionally. Randy Jerwitz talked specifically about the use of dogs to hunt wolves. For someone like him and for the people that brought the lawsuit, they consider it animal cruelty for both the dogs and the wolves. So there is just sort of that extra layer going on there that is really important to a lot of people.
You've said that Kathy Stepp is clear in her vision that she is doing what needs to be done with the DNR. I think one of the things I read, she told her staff that they should be not prohibiting but permitting. And that gets into a lot of issues. It's when are there enough frac sand mine operations or when is the well properly placed and monitored? It all gets very complex.
According to her, if the DNR is not seen as an adversary, any sort of permitting issues or compliancy will sort of naturally fall into place because people won't be afraid to engage DNR when they are working on a project and the DNR officials can work with them before they make any missteps instead of punishing them after. So a lot of her focus is on sort of streamlining that permitting process and getting people, getting developers and small business owners set up with a point person at DNR so that they can work together on their projects all along the way instead of running into something that needs to be prosecuted later. I suspect that critics only hear the streamlining permitting process, and critics have said that they feel that science-based decisions go by the wayside in favor of making things easier for developers. And according to Stepp, both are possible. It doesn't have to be one or the other. That the focus in the past at DNR has been all about science, and that she mentioned the importance of social science and the importance of people and what they think about things and how they feel about things, and that that needs to be part of the process.
Do you think that we're at a critical point of figuring out what the DNR should be doing? What should its mission be?
I think that the critics believe that the current DNR is yet another example of the state of Wisconsin under Governor Walker, that he has put his people in place throughout the state and that every agency reflects that. There were many, many controversies. I think that the Sporting Heritage Grant sort of exemplified what some of the critics have been saying, that these same names coming up over and over again, the connections that these people have with each other, the ties to special interests, these are the things that were so glaring to critics in that particular example and then across some of these other examples. For people who are already critical of Walker's administration, I would say that the current DNR example fits right in for them.
What did you unearth that you didn't expect to find?
Well, to be honest, my experience with DNR as a kid growing up on some property with a trout stream and some ponds was that you didn't sneeze without the DNR showing up. And I assumed that that's the way things still were. I think I've kind of stayed out of it, and I was quite surprised to learn about all of these different changes, particularly in lower enforcement. And I think that it was in the story, Randy Jurowitz essentially says that. He says, you know, a lot of people think this is the DNR you knew when you were a kid. And that is no longer the case. This is a new DNR. And many people just don't realize that, that a lot of people just aren't aware of the changes. I personally wasn't aware of just how many frack sand mining operations there are. I think if I lived in western Wisconsin, I might be more aware of it. You know, I think that the people who live where they live are experiencing pretty significant issues related to where they live in the state. But I wasn't aware of a bigger picture of all the different things that are going on within Wisconsin, particularly related to natural resource protection.
These are very interesting times.
Yes, I think there's no way that I could have possibly done justice to covering all of it. But I came away with the experience with a lot more questions, I think, for myself anyway, than answers. And I think, you know, I think that's the idea. What's clear is that everybody cares about Wisconsin. That didn't seem to be at issue. At issue is how to protect it and how to address what's going on. And there's the old way and there's the new way. And as someone says in the end, you know, I guess I'd like it back to where it was.
Maggie Ginsburg-Schutz is a writer based in South Central Wisconsin. Her article on the DNR and Secretary Kathy Stepp is in the forthcoming January issue of Milwaukee Magazine. Some cheesy suggestions for your holiday table come your way when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Mitch Tyke. You planning a party this Christmas or New Year's? Perhaps a cheese platter is in order. But you are not satisfied with the ready-made platters at the local grocery store? Cheese writer Jeanette Hurt has just the recipe for you. She tells Lake Effect's Stephanie Lecce that she's come across some great cheesy finds for you this year.
The first is Rush Creek Reserve. Now, I'm sure you're familiar with Pleasant Ridge Reserve.
Yes.
The most award-winning cheese in the whole world, I think.
We've definitely talked about that here.
Yes. Well, they're making another cheese, and it's Rush Creek Reserve. And it's a lovely, more than 60 days aged washed rind, but it's light, it's really creamy, really flavorful, earthy, rich. Last Friday, before we went to the Bucks Bulls game with my parents, I served some, and my mom already asked me to bring it to Christmas dinner. She said it's really, really good.
So if we were to put this out on our table or, you know, serve it as maybe an appetizer for our party, what would we serve it with?
You could serve it with perhaps some sort of Christmassy type jam and then just some crusty bread, and it would be absolutely amazing. Another really exciting spreadable, but this is more of a true bloomy rind, an ash-coated blooming rind, is made by Katie Hedricks out of LeClaire Farms. If you may remember, she won first place at the U.S. Cheese Championship for her Evelon, her aged goat cheese, which has a delightful Evelon cheese that is flavored with cumin, which was just to die for. But that's another wonderful cheese. But the cheese that I'm most excited about right now is a cow-goat blend. It's an ash-coated bloomy rind cheese, and it's called Martone. It reminds me of some of the cheeses you get out of California, very elegant, light, not aged goat cheeses. And this is a goat cow blend.
What does that do to the flavor, to the texture?
Well, the texture is very similar, but the flavor, it tempers down that goat flavor. So it's not quite straight, fresh goat. It's got that cream of cow tang to it. Now we'll go into more of the Swiss cheeses. And Raleigh, whose milk goes into her Martone cheese, Raleigh makes a cellar-aged Alpine, they call it. But it's sort of like a Wisconsin version of Appenzeller. So now you can actually make a full – usually what I would do in the past when I would make a fondue is I usually get Gruyere and Emmentaler, and I would get Wisconsin ones, but then I'd have to get the Swiss Appenzeller, but now I don't anymore because there's Wisconsin version. It's a lovely, nutty, aged Swiss-style cheese, which we haven't had for a while.
And again, what would we be putting with that? You said you would use it in your fondue. So what
you could
what
use it with your fondue,
then?
But you could also serve it straight. It's just one of those great Swiss cheeses you could add to your cheese plate. The other interesting cheese, Roth is making a Montanella raclette. Now, raclette is a traditional melting cheese. You heat it and it gets all melty, and then you put it over boiled potatoes or cornichon pickles. But they used to make this raclette years ago, but then they brought it back and they've tweaked the recipe. So now there's also a Wisconsin raclette. And raclette, I ran into a woman while I was at Larry's, and she's like, oh, it's perfect for holidays, for New Year's, things like that. You get a raclette machine, which you can either rent or you can buy. There are these little trays, and you put the cheese on, either sliced or shredded, and it gets all melty and bubbly, and then you scrape it right onto the potatoes or the bread. So it's sort of like fondue without melting and fondue without other ingredients. It's just straight melty cheese. And you serve it with a salad and dessert, and that's your entertainment. And some other interesting cheeses. There's Bellavitano, of course, is a great addictive cheese. And my favorite is the raspberry ale washed version. But they have another new version, which is a chai tea washed
Ooh.
Version. Which is very interesting, and I think it also has sort of like the Christmassy sort of flavors. And it would pair, of course, perfectly with chai tea. So if you have a cup of chai tea on Christmas morning, and then you have your chai-washed cheese, that's a perfect Christmas morning breakfast. Or you could leave it out for Santa, too.
I'm sure he'd enjoy that on a frosty night.
So, but you also probably would want a blue cheese if you're going to do a whole cheese plate. And there's a couple of interesting blues. We've talked before about You Have to Be Kidding Me, which is by Hooks, and they make some amazing blues. But probably my favorite is their You Have to Be Kidding Me because it's sheep, goat, and cow. And the name just says it all. It's just too funny. And then Katie and Chris Raleigh from Raleigh Cheese again, make a dry blue jack called Ziggy Zacky Blue.
And that would really round out our cheese platters.
I think so. And if you wanted something else, again, if you wanted something more mild that would appeal to lots of people, I would say get a Gouda, Marika Gouda. And she's got some interesting flavors there, of course. The black pepper is one of her new ones, or newer ones, which is a good one. And she has cumin, and she has things like fenugreek, that was her first award-winning cheese, and of course just her straight-aged is great. And then one other cheese I wanted to tell you about that I came across at Trader Joe's, and I was very, very excited because it's my favorite Utah cheese.
Utah cheese.
Yes. Barely Buzzed. It's a coffee and lavender rub cheddar that's just fabulous. And it's at Trader Joe's, and it's not very expensive either.
What about cheeses to gift? How do you gauge, if you're not really sure what a person's palate is like for cheese, what would be some suggestions you would give for good cheeses to give?
You probably would want to do something like a Cheese of the Month club type thing. And funny you should ask about that. There's a woman who lives in Chicago. She's originally from Greene County, from Monroe, Wisconsin. And she worked in technology for Groupon. And she noticed that most of the Cheese of the Month things were either very, very expensive, like $100 a month, or they were from specific cheese stores or cheese companies. But there wasn't just a good sort of entry enthusiast level box for the month. So for $35 a month, you can get a box of three different cheeses. She usually tries to put in one really, really nice cheese, one sort of middle of the rows but approachable cheese, and then something fun like the cranberry cheddar. Her company is called Yankee Hollow, and it's named after her grandfather's creamery, which he started at the turn of the previous century. So she was very excited to do this. And what she does, though, is she sources cheeses from around the country, but as she put it, she's a Wisconsin girl. So 75% of the cheese is from Wisconsin.
Well, Jeanette, we'll have to have you back on to tell us about cheeses in 2014.
That sounds great.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Jeanette Hurt is a Milwaukee-based food writer. Her books include The Cheeses of Wisconsin, a culinary travel guide, and The Complete Idiot's Guide to Wine and Food Pairing. She spoke with Stephanie Lecce. That's another week's worth of Lake Effects. We're produced by Dan Harmon, Bonnie North, and Stephanie Lecce, with the assistance of Eleanor Peterson and Nathan Royster, the web support of Michelle Maternowski, and studio engineering by John Strelecki. I'm Mitch Tyke. Have a terrific weekend. Go forth and finish your Christmas shopping. And tune in tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend from WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next.